Hi, it's Tom here, and before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I just want to say a huge thank you to all of our listeners and readers who generously donate to us, either monthly or whenever you can. Spikes is free, we want to keep it free, and we rely on the generosity of our readers and our listeners to do so. So, to those who already give, a huge thank you. And to those who don't, please do consider giving whatever you can, whenever you can, to keep Spiked going and growing. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit the big red donate button in the top right of the homepage. Thanks again, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things Nanny State. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked, and this is the show where myself and the IEA's Chris Snowden discuss the latest in public health killjoyism, all with the help of an invited guest. Today we're joined by the author, broadcaster and comedian Tamandra Harkness to discuss Boris and the sugar tax, San Francisco's vaping ban, spice in prisons, minimum pricing and much more. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, Spike's Nanny State podcast. I'm Tom Slater, and today, as ever, I'm joined by the IEA's Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hi, everybody.
And our very special guest for today is the broadcaster, writer and comedian Tamandra Harkness. Hello, Tamandra.
Hi.
So to kick things off, Tamandra, I hear you've got a new Edinburgh show all about risks. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, please. It's called Take a Risk, and it's all about risk. It's turning out to be mainly me playing games with the audience and seeing what kind of risks they are willing to take. I realise saying that might put people off coming, or it might encourage people to come. It's hard to know. I realised I was very interested in risk from all sorts of directions. Obviously, the bit of me that did a maths degree just for kicks likes the kind of probability, mathematical, can we predict what's going to happen side. The human bit of me likes what goes on in our minds when we decide what risks to take. And then having looked at big data, especially in stats over the last few years, I realised that there's kind of two angles to it in society, like socially or politically, if you like. There is taking risks. So you decide that the future's uncertain, but you're going to go for something, even though you don't know what the outcome's going to be, because you think it's got potential. But there's being at risk, which is like a state that adheres to you like a kind of miasma, just because you belong in a certain subpopulation. And then someone statistically says, oh, well, you know, you're 50% more likely to have a heart attack, your kids are half as likely to get good GCSEs and that kind of thing. And I think that's quite interesting, that idea that when you take risks, it's like you're being active, you're taking control of your life. And when you're at risk, you're absolutely passive and stuff just happens to you.
Am I right in thinking there's an electric shock machine involved in all this?
There is an electric shock machine, which I happened to own for my previous show. And to be honest, that was the bit of the show that people found quite exciting. Mm. And even then, that was in my show Brain Sex, which was about the idea that, God, you know, I was ahead of my time, about the idea that men and women, do we have different brains? Mm. Is that what explains what's different? And I was exploring differences in appetite for risk. So I would get someone from the audience to gamble with me. And if they won, they won money. And if they lost, they got electric shock.
Brilliant. And where can people find it? What's the venue? What's the run?
It's at the Roxy downstairs, which is venue 139. And it's on, I'm afraid it's 11:50 in the morning. It's a bit early.
But it's been electrocuted.
You say that, you'd be surprised how many people are disappointed when they don't get electrocuted.
Whatever time of day.
There's a whole thing. Anyway, sorry, yeah, it's 11:50 in the morning.
You've got a very distinctive audience, I think.
Well, it's called Take a Risk, so I think it's going to be a bit self-selecting anyway. 11:50 in the morning starts the 31st of July, which is in itself terrifying.
Brilliant. We look forward to that. Now, Chris, you don't have an Edinburgh show, unfortunately, but you did get a bit of good news recently. When the man who is all but certain to be our next Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, came out against sin taxes, calling for a review and causing a lot of consternation in the process. What did you make of all of that? Are you excited?
I enjoyed the consternation. It's very exciting. I mean, all he did really was say that he's not minded to introduce a milkshake tax, which nobody had even thought about until about 3 months ago. And the government apparently has got plans to do such and maybe extend the sugar levy to food as well, as Dame Sally Davis would like to do before she leaves her post as chief medical officer. So that's really all he said. He also said that he'd like to base taxes on evidence. Not a bad idea. And he'd like to have a bit of a review to see if things like the sugar levy do what they're supposed to do, which is reduce obesity. A lot of people seem to have forgotten that. They seem to think it's about making Ribena taste horrible, and that's a success in itself. And whether they clobber the poor. And he took a pretty sound line in it, saying, you know, I'm concerned that these kind of indirect stealth slash sin taxes hit the poor, which they unequivocally do. There's really no denying that. But the squealing and howling from so many sections of the press and the public health campaigners was a joy to see. And it just shows you, it's kind of like, in a very small way, Brexit, you know, in that you have this journey, you know, it seems to a lot of people as if history just goes in one direction. And with the EU, it was just more and more kind of federalism. And with the nanny states, just more and more taxes and bans. And eventually we'll have plain packaged crisps and a chocolate bar will cost 10 quid. And that's just the way it's going to be, because that was the mentality. And then you get someone like Boris standing up, as you say, you know, a strong favourite to be the next prime minister, and says, I'm actually not that keen on this, and I'm not going to take this any further, and I might even go backwards. And people just can't get their head around it. And so you immediately get, the Labour Party was doing the whole who funds you thing, and good old Carol Cadwallader was saying that the, you know, sugar barons in Belize were close to Andy Wigmore. Andy Wigmore probably has met Boris Johnson. Yeah, just the fantastic stuff that, you know, the kind of thing the IA puts up with quite a bit. So, yeah, it's great to see people's head explode about it. I hope he does it. He's not known for being particularly reliable, but I hope he does it.
Definitely a flip-flopper on this issue, because he used to back the sugar tax when he was mayor of London, I think. I think he introduced it in the City Hall Cafe.
Yeah, apparently
so. Small
experiment.
But, Tamandra, what did you make of all this? Do you think we're on the verge of a public health Brexit moment?
I'd like to think so. But again, I mean, years ago, I voted Boris for Mayor of London because he seemed like he was a bit more relaxed about what we get up to in our private lives than Ken Livingstone, certainly. And then the first thing he did was ban drinking on the tube. So I'm not holding my breath. But it would be good if, I mean, it's good at least that he stood up and said, I'd like to see some evidence that this does what we wanted it to do before we keep introducing it, because the evidence of most of these things seems really shaky. I mean, there's kind of two things, aren't there? I mean, there is the question of, does it work? Does it do what we wanted it to do? And then there's the question of, even if it does work, is it right?
Is it worth it?
Yeah. To restrict what people can do if they choose to take risks.
At huge expense. At
expense to them. Exactly. So, you know, those are two slightly different questions. But even the call for evidence, I think, is progress, because very often I heard a great phrase recently from David Spiegelhalter. I did a book launch for his new book on statistics, which of course is great, and he used the phrase white hat bias. So that people who think that they're in the right, so people like public health campaigners, you know, want to save people from themselves, think, well, we're doing the right thing, so don't question us on the actual detail of what we're actually doing, because we're on the side of the goodies. And I think there's a lot of that in things like sugar taxes, where people say, well, you know, stop trying to look for evidence that this actually works, because it's obviously a good thing to do because we're in a good moral position. Whereas actually, if you looked at whether these things work, I think quite often they don't.
Yeah, and the great example of that is, I think we've mentioned it before on a podcast, our old friend, the Reverend Mike Rayner. Because there is going to be a review of the sugar tax. It's already underway. It'll be published at some point in the next year or two. But the job of reviewing it has been given for at least £1 million to various academics who all support the sugar tax or came up with the modelling in the first place that said it's going to work. And in the case of Mike Rayner, a guy who literally believes that God told him to bring about a sugar tax in Britain. And he's on the record saying that. So I question how impartial this review is going to be. I agree with Boris; it should be reviewed.
Steady on.
But it is being reviewed, and you know, I could write that review for them now. You know, I know what they're going to say, regardless of what happens. They'll say, at the very least, they'll say obesity would have gone up more had it not been for the sugar tax, which is always a great get-out-of-jail card, even if Beastie skyrockets, they could say, well, it would have gone even higher.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem with ecological studies. Unless you randomised half the places in the UK to have a sugar tax and the other half not to, and went back and weighed people and...
Yeah, but that's
found out. But you know, you never can tell what would have happened if you didn't do it. But I agree with you. Asking the people who came up with the policy to do the impartial review seems a bit lazy.
Well, corrupt, I would say.
Yeah, corrupt.
We very nearly started on a good news story, but that quickly turned to bad. So let's move on to another bad news story. And the first topic we're going to talk about today in depth is the news that San Francisco has become the first city in the US to ban the sale of e-cigarettes. Officials voted recently for this ban, not only in shops in San Francisco selling them, but also online retailers actually delivering them to places in San Francisco. Particularly interesting given the fact that Juul Labs, which is the biggest manufacturer of e-cigs in the US by a country mile, is actually based in San Francisco, as well as the fact that once upon a time it, as a city, obviously had a reputation as being a little bit libertine, a little bit about cutting loose. But Chris, can you tell us a little bit about this story? Kind of what's the background to it and why did they decide to go for this?
Well, the background is really the Juuling epidemic. You just mentioned Juul. It has a huge proportion of the market apparently over there. Now, Juul, if you don't know it, listeners, is usually compared to a USB stick. It's basically thin and rectangular and therefore is slightly less unattractive than the kind of e-cigarette that I use, big old bulky things. It also makes it quite good for stealth vaping. So you can hold it in your hand quite subtly and, have a quick toke on it.
Is it like my granddad used to do the rollies, where you can hold it inside your hand?
Exactly.
Little...
It's exactly like
nobody
that, yeah.
Can see
and then
it.
You can slip into your top pocket or whatever.
You can't do that with rollies.
No, true. Very unobtrusive. And as a result, partly of that, apparently quite a lot of high school students have been getting onto the Juul and they're vaping in class. Apparently. Now, I don't know how much truth there is in this, whether it's a big moral panic or what, but I think there's certainly at least a gem of truth in the fact that younger people are Juuling and possibly they wouldn't be using e-cigarettes were they not Juuling. Now, in America, because they're so weird over there, they classify e-cigarettes as tobacco products. And that's been very good for the scaremongers because they're able to claim that tobacco use has rocketed up amongst high school students. In actual fact, if you drill into the figures a little bit, you'll see smoking has plummeted at the same time as e-cigarette use has gone up. And a lot of people who are classified as e-cigarette users are people who've used it once in their lifetime or once in the last year. They're not necessarily using it very often, and I don't think many of them are. Moreover, they are not progressing on to cigarettes, and the statistics show that pretty clearly. But that hasn't stopped this massive panic about vaping. So there is a push in America to increase the age at which you can start buying tobacco products to 21. This is not really aimed actually at cigarettes. It's aimed at vaping, but they've classified the two as tobacco products. And San Francisco has gone one step further. This ban is only aimed at vaping. This, you can still buy cigarettes from the age, I think, of 18, certainly 21, but you won't be able to ban vaping products. And San Francisco is just one of the worst places in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I wrote an article recently, I started off by saying that since the fall of the ISIS caliphate, it's left to San Francisco to resist the Enlightenment. And they're doing a pretty good job. They just ban things all the time. Everything's got a cancer warning on it. They're nuts. They're anti-scientific. They're unspeakable people exist over in San Francisco. And plus, they've got the worst anti-smoking academics based in the university there. So they've really gone after vaping and have really revealed more explicitly than anywhere else in the States how mad the whole campaign is, that they are specifically now, they're not just trying to get rid of both tobacco and vaping, they are trying to get rid of specifically vaping because they think it's a gateway to tobacco, which it isn't.
And Tamandra, what do you make of all this? Because Matt Ridley wrote something about this particular story and he quoted the mayor of San Francisco who made this point that, you know, tobacco is one of the greatest causes of death in this country. You know, it's more deadly than AIDS, alcohol, car accidents, illegal drugs, murders, everything else combined. But then said he was going to ban not tobacco, but the thing that could actually get people off tobacco. You know, what is it about e-cigarettes that seems to send allegedly, you know, kind of pro-evidence public health people just completely off the deep end, completely the wrong way, and clamping down on something which, you know, most scientists reckon, you know, 95% more safe than cigarettes is a conservative estimate with e-cigarettes. Why is it that that 5% apparently is enough reason to do this kind of crazy stuff?
Well, I have the urge to slightly defend San Francisco in general, because it's you know, I think they have some very good impulses. They're quite good on things like privacy. But I do agree with you on when it comes to health things and banning things. I don't know if it's a reaction to against being hippies or if it's something from being hippies or what. I don't know where it comes from. The e-cigarette ban is completely irrational, utterly, utterly irrational. I mean, most of the people I know who've given up smoking have done it through using e-cigarettes instead. And the medical evidence of trials they've done in the UK show that you're about twice as likely to give up smoking cigarettes if you use e-cigarettes than if you use, you know, patches, gum, whatever the other replacement things are. So it seems completely perverse to take away that route to not smoking cigarettes, even if you think there is some harm in them, which, you know, seems reasonably likely. We don't really know yet. We haven't had the studies, but everyone seems to agree they're a lot less harmful than smoking. And he's right. I mean, smoking is kind of up there in the long-term health risk, really in a league of its own. People keep trying to say obesity is the new smoking or whatever's the new smoking. But really, people giving up smoking cigarettes is behind the great surge in life expectancy, which is slowing down now. And oddly enough, just as a side issue, I'm actually working a radio documentary to go out in September about life expectancy and why it's slowing down. But I can't see any rationale behind banning e-cigarettes and hanging on to cigarettes. I just think from whatever point of view, whatever you're trying to achieve, it seems crazy. The only thing I'm wondering is there some particular political thing within California? Are they leaning on Yule because they're based there, trying to get them to do something else? I mean, if you're worried about high school kids hiding them, you know, get a minimum size. Say no e-cigarette product shall be small enough for a high school student to conceal. That's not a serious suggestion.
Chris, why are they going after it? You know, I mean, surely the logic of this is just to ban tobacco. Why would they go after e-cigarettes?
I think there's a danger that we're treating people in San Francisco as if they're rational in any way, rational, and they're not. It's just a different planet. You know, the sooner it falls in the Pacific Ocean, the better. You know, I hate the place. It is. I'm not kidding. You know, what I said about ISIS. You know, they really are the enemies of reason in the world. And the tragic thing is, the rest of the states and certainly the rest of California starts to follow them. Then the rest of America follows California, and the rest of the world follows the states. It's very worrying, but there isn't really any logical reason. You can't say, oh, it's probably, you know, a lot of the time in America, you know, lobbying does come into it in a big way. People say it does over here. I don't think it does that much, actually. But in America, they're pretty upfront about it. You know, a lot of the FDA's anti-vaping stuff has been pushed by the pharmaceutical industry and probably the tobacco industry as well. But in San Francisco, I don't think you can even find a lobby that seems to be responsible. They're just nuts. They see this. They think it's a threat. Maybe, you know, maybe they genuinely believe it's a gateway. One of the guys from one of the nutty universities over there in some tobacco center, said that they might look at banning cigarettes next, but the first step has got to be banning e-cigarettes. But yeah, it is worth discussing the possibility of banning cigarettes, because there is evidence that they are as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than e-cigarettes. So literally what she said. It's bonkers. They had an economist over there who was addressing the question of, is this ban on vaping going to negatively affect the economy? And he said, no, we don't think there's going to be any damage to the economy, because the people who are currently buying e-cigarettes will just start buying cigarettes instead, so it's a wash. It's like, well, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they'll do. You know, don't you see the problem with your kind of the health policy here?
Well, I hate you to write off a whole city as irrational, but you do ask yourself, what have they been smoking?
Yeah, well, and injecting. I mean, this is the thing about San Francisco. It's such a shithole, really. You know, people's vision of it is, if they haven't been there for a long time, is so out of kilter with what it's actually like. I remember on the Beatles documentary, George Harrison in 1967 says he went over to San Francisco because he'd heard it was great over there, and he was just disgusted at the state of it, all these horrible, drugged-up kids living around in filth. And it's got so much worse since then. They've got a major problem with people shitting in the street. in San Francisco. It is absolutely
epidemic. They've got an app where you can map where people shit in the street in San Francisco. Yeah.
Is that true? And
yeah, it's absolutely true. Yeah, you can have on a map. It shows you where human waste can be found in San Francisco. But disappointingly, instead of it being a brown blob, they show it was a blue dot. Isn't that just like the worst use of technology you can imagine?
I'm impressed they can do it at all. I'd like to know how they do some kind of very elaborate GPS
system.
It
does say a lot about a city where you've both got like the richest and the most high-tech people in the world and the probably the greatest density. I'm making this up, may not be true, but certainly to the naked eye, the greatest density of drug-using homeless people in the same city.
They've got more homeless people in San Francisco than we have in the entire of the United Kingdom. They've got thousands and thousands of syringes lying around the place, but they're banning plastic bags and vaping. You know, it's just unbelievable.
I do admire, Chris, your ability to sound like someone at least twice your age. Listeners, you'd never believe he's under 60, would you?
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a moment to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So next up, let's talk about spice. So a recent survey of 1,600 members of prison staff in the UK has found that a third of prison officers and nurses have been falling ill as a result of inhaling secondhand smoke from this drug known as spice. Thousands of prisoners as well, we're told, are seeking medical attention each year after consuming the drug, which is said to, amongst other effects, make people violent and zombie-like. So this is a synthetic form of cannabis, was until relatively recently a legal high, but despite now being banned by the UK government, has spread in prisons and also among the homeless like wildfire. So Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit more about spice? What is it and what problems is it causing?
Well, you described spice pretty well. It's the zombie drug that has been, it used to be a legal high. And then I think 2 years ago in the Psychoactive Substances Act, it was banned and nobody's ever used it since because that's how prohibition works. So that was great. End of the story, really. and they banned smoking in prisons around about the same time, kind of had a phased role. Now, the ban on smoking in prisons is pretty interesting. It kind of started with this sex offender who's in jail, and he lodged a court case. He doesn't like secondhand smoke. And this backs up actually my theory that people who object to smoking are perverts and criminals.
You heard it here first.
but do you have any evidence for that?
Well, it's N equals one.
I'm worried if you've got some anecdotes.
The evidence is good enough for me. This guy's a sex offender and he's anti-smoking. And he wanted access to the whatever phone line it is that you can dob in people who are breaking the smoking ban, because people, he said, were smoking in the common areas of prisons. Now, the smoking ban 2006 banned smoking in the common areas, but you could still smoke in your cell. And Patricia Hewitt, remember her, health secretary at the time, she made it very clear that that was people's homes. We're not going to try banning smoking in people's homes. Nobody, including Action on Smoke and Health, were asking for a ban in people's prison cells at the time. Okay, but things snowball. So this sex offender got involved, and it was an interesting case. It went back and forth, back and forth. He was essentially saying there should be a complete ban. And the government's defense was kind of weird. But in the end, the government won. It went to the High Court, then to the Appeals Court. And then December 2017, it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, effectively, that the smoking ban does not apply to Crown property because it doesn't explicitly say that it does. And if the government had wanted it to apply to Crown property, it would have said so. And it hasn't, so it doesn't. So effectively, as I understand it, any government-owned building that says you can't smoke in it, that's not actually the law, unless they've changed it. They might have changed it since December 2017, but I haven't heard about it. So it was this massive loophole. But anyway, it didn't really matter by then because the government had already committed to totally smoke-free prisons, indoors, outdoors, common areas, prison cells, the lot. Action on Smoking Health said this won't cause riots, even though there's been loads of riots around the world whenever they bring in smoking bans. And there were loads of riots in Britain, Birmingham, various places. Birmingham was the biggest one. Place was on fire for quite a while. There were riots. Violence is at an all-time high. You might remember good old Rory Stewart saying last year that he was going to bring down prison violence, otherwise he was going to resign. Of course, he got a sideways move. I don't think they'll bring down prison violence significantly until they let them smoke again. But what they are doing as a partial substitute is they're getting on the spice. And although secondhand smoke wasn't really an issue before, As far as I can tell, there weren't many prison officers complaining about it or anything. Now, secondhand spice smoke is a massive problem, and you get in the kind of hospitalizations and people passing out and all this kind of stuff. So it's a wonderful example of how prohibition always works.
And on that point, I mean, it was even interesting. I mean, the only reason anyone ever seemed to smoke spice to begin with is because of the fact it was cheaper and legal, you know, the alternative to cannabis. It was always had a pretty bad rep, but it was interesting as well. You mentioned the psychoactive substances bill. That seemed to me to be such a ridiculous piece of legislation as well. I remember they had to put out, because the definition of what was a psychoactive substance, what was a legal high that they then wanted to criminalise, was so broad, they ended up putting out this disclaimer that food, alcohol, tobacco, nicotine, caffeine and medical products would
yeah,
be exempt.
They had to explicitly exempt tea and coffee.
It tells you something about where we've ended
up.
It's
not a good sign for a law, is it, where you have to explicitly say you can still drink tea? it's a warning bell should be going off at that point.
It's not going to go down. Well, Tamandra, what do you make of all this?
Well, it does seem pretty... I mean, I don't know a lot about prison reform, but it does seem pretty common sense to me that if one of the few things people can do to relax and chill out in quite a bad situation for them is to smoke, and you take that away, then you're heading for trouble. And certainly, I mean, spice is a really nasty thing. I think spice does make people violent and aggressive and quite out of it. And it, of all the things you'd want prisoners on, it wouldn't be that,
yeah.
I think. So, I mean, it's obviously two slightly different but linked issues. I'm sure illegal drugs in prisons has always been a problem. But I can't help agreeing that banning cigarettes is going to exacerbate that. It's very funny. It's so Crown property. So basically, is that just so that the Queen can basically smoke wherever she wants? Because otherwise, she'd be living in Crown property and then not be allowed to smoke in her own home, would she?
Well, Buckingham Palace, definitely you can smoke in, because the Queen told them to take down the no smoking signs. When the smoking man came in, she actually either took them down or they were trying to put them up and said, no, we're not having that. I mean, not that she smokes or anything, but she just doesn't agree with that. So I guess that's Crown property. I don't really know the difference between Crown property and government property. What is there a difference?
Don't know.
Would a library, property lawyer, when you need one.
By the government, would that count as Crown property? A police station?
No, I think Crown property is like belongs to the Crown, so it's like central government. I mean, probably Westminster, isn't the Palace of Westminster?
Yeah,
couldn't
that's
you still smoke there
yeah,
if you
yeah,
wanted
you
to?
You can, in theory, still smoke there, yeah.
Yeah.
They won't let you.
I think listeners should try this stuff out. Go to your local library, police station.
Buckingham Palace,
yeah, give it a go.
Right. House of Parliament.
Top of a swan, I don't know.
This is not official legal advice. I'm not responsible for anything that may happen.
It's quite an interesting dynamic, though, that the way that it happened. And I think it reflects the fact that, although, yes, governments are quite open to the idea of banning things, and whenever there's something must be done, let's ban something, is quite a common impulse. Government.
Say that again.
There is also that pull factor of individuals saying, well, I insist on being protected from this other thing that somebody else might do, and the way I want to be protected is I want someone to ban it. And then at that point, the authorities are naturally going to say, well, okay, well, this is easy for us then, because all we have to do is stop other people from doing something, and it's not really going to cost us anything. We might even get some fine money, but there is that kind of, I think, double dynamic that sometimes it's not necessarily a push from above. It's a pull from individuals who have decided that. Not only sex offenders, Chris. but it's just that instead of people being able to go, well, you know what, you have to have a bit of tolerance and other people have annoying habits and we just have to rub along together. And I'm sure I've got habits they don't like sex offending, or probably more innocuous ones in most cases.
Sex offending should be banned, to be fair. I think it is, actually.
I think the fact that he was in prison, suggest that's true. But that also does worry me, that way that instead of us going, you know what, I don't like your habits particularly, I don't like fox hunting, I don't like... I personally don't like people having piercings. I'm really squeamish about it. But I don't go around saying nobody should be allowed to have a visible piercing.
And it seems like, especially the things in relation to prisons, also stuff around hospitals, mental hospitals as well, mental health hospitals. It's just really the nanny status. It's most kind of nasty and petty when you think about it. You know, all these things to move, not allow people smoking outside of hospital doors. You know, people with severe mental illness not being able to smoke, even not just in the buildings in which they live, but actually, you know, on the ground, etc. Yeah. And with the prison problem as well, it's not even, you know, is it going to make matters worse? But there's just something so nasty about all that. Some people in very tough conditions. Yeah.
It's very vindictive in mental health institutions. I think with prisons, you could almost make the argument, well, you're there to be punished. Smoking's enjoyable. We're taking that pleasure away. You could make that case, right?
Small pleasure, though, right? You know, in comparison to...
It's probably a pretty... Well, it's a big pleasure, smoking, anyway. Probably especially in prison. But maybe that would act as a deterrent, right? 80% of prisoners smoke. Is that right? You can't smoke when you go to prison, so think twice about it. Probably wouldn't work as a deterrent, but I'm just throwing it out there, right? But mental health institutions, we're not talking about criminals. We're talking about people who need help. And, you know, there are people in mental health institutions who sign themselves out early or resist going for help because they know they won't be able to smoke in the gardens, right? They ban you from smoking everywhere in these places. And it's just so unnecessary and cruel and vindictive.
I long for the days many years ago, my auntie was going through a stressful time and she said she was trying to give up smoking and the doctor said to her, don't give up smoking. Keep smoking. Otherwise, I'm going to have to put you on Valium, and that's much worse.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a serious point in there, which I think the rise of opiates and antidepressants, it does correlate pretty well with the decline in smoking. I think there is a connection. But again, I can't prove it. It's like my sex offender theory. Yeah. I'm working on this. I'm doing more field research, but I'm throwing it out there to start with. Maybe somebody else can pick it up and run with it. I'm busy.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, no bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do that, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show.
So finally, let's turn to our final topic and our old friend, minimum pricing. So official figures released this past month suggest that the Scots are drinking less than they did before minimum unit pricing for alcohol came into force in Scotland in May last year. Minimum pricing, of course, is this big flagship policy of the SNP, held up for years by legal challenges, but we finally got about, it's been in place for just over a year now. And people are already hailing it as a huge success on the back of these figures. I think even Irish PM Leo Varadkar has said he's going to look again at minimum pricing. Chris, what did you make of these numbers? Are the claims being made about the great success of minimum pricing all they seem to be?
This is so frustrating because it's the media dropping a ball again. So we had the figures, the official figures for the amount of alcohol consumed per head in Scotland were published a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And they were accompanied by a big press release and quotes from the Scottish Public Health Minister and various other people saying this is very encouraging because it had gone down. Per capita consumption had gone down by just under 3%. Right, a couple of things about this. Firstly, minimum pricing only came in May 2018. So this is not the first 12 months of minimum pricing, regardless. Secondly, a decline of just under 3% is par for the course, quite honestly. It's certainly not unusual. The consumption has gone down 9 out of the last 11 years in Scotland. It's gone down by more than 3% in a couple of those years. There's nothing special or unique about a decline of that magnitude. Nevertheless, it's still, I guess, fairly interesting. You know, I suppose if it had gone up a lot, I would have said, oh, there you go, minimum pricing has failed. But it was reported as a great success for minimum pricing. Very few journalists bothered to even mention that we're only dealing with 8 months of minimum pricing in the first four. Didn't have minimum pricing. But the really frustrating thing was the following week, the same body, but certainly the government, put out figures for the number of alcohol-related deaths in 2018. Now, same caveat apply. It was only 8 months minimum pricing, but the number of deaths went up, right? By 1.5% from memory. Nobody covered this. There was no press release, as far as I know. There was no comments from anybody in government or anyone from public health. It was completely buried. Not a single newspaper even mentioned it. Can you imagine if deaths had fallen by any amount? It would have been everywhere. Really, these two sets of figures, by the way, should have been published on the same day, and then maybe a bit more difficult for people to cherry pick. But it's just so pathetic, you know? I mean, the primary outcome for minimum pricing clearly is alcohol-related death. It's not consumption per se. You might expect those to go in the same direction, but not necessarily in this particular instance. They didn't. But to completely ignore it, having paid so much attention to a very similar bit of data only a week earlier, I think was utterly negligent on the part of the press. I can understand public health people wanting to bury it, but I don't understand why the Times and the Sun did as well.
I mean, it's kind of revealing as well, because as you say, the argument was always made that this is about just saving lives. You know, I think they even put a number on it at one point. As the
58. This is the thing. I mean, so people were coming back and saying, when I was raising this, last week, I think, people were saying, well, you wouldn't expect to see an impact in the first year. There's a lag effect and all this kind of stuff. Well, actually, there isn't much of a lag effect with alcohol. It's quite interesting. The famous example that's often given is the First World War in France, where as soon as the war started, you had obviously a lot of young men were sent off to war. There was restrictions on food and alcohol, rationing and so on. And the number of liver cirrhosis deaths fell really sharply within a year. So you do actually see these kind of very immediate effects, not on everything, but on a lot of things. And so that's one of the reasons that the model, the famous model that provided all the evidence essentially for this before it was introduced, they specified exactly 58 fewer deaths. They said there'd be however many fewer hospital admissions. They predicted 3.5% decline in consumption. They predicted everything. Crime was going to go down by such and such. It was unbelievably specific. There weren't even confidence intervals in it. It was just 58, exactly 58 deaths. So, yeah, they did predict an immediate effect. Mm. And from what we can tell, there wasn't one.
Mm.
I mean, the first thing is I'm surprised to hear that about the lack of lag, because my instinct, and if I'd been a journalist looking at that, I would have said, well, I wouldn't expect them to go, even if this was working to reduce drinking, I wouldn't expect it to have any impact on deaths for a number of years.
Well, the theory is that you get people who are basically teetering on the brink of death. Well, no, seriously. So you get people who they've been drinking a lot for a long time, but the liver's a very robust organ. If you just cut down,
then you're unlikely to die in the short term. Then, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's obviously poisoning deaths where you just...
And that is what I've actually got,
acute instances. Yeah. But no, that's an interesting point, and I'm glad to learn it. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's always very telling what figures they publish. I'd heard that consumption went up in Scotland immediately after the minimum alcohol pricing. That was a news story quite shortly afterwards, yeah. I think. So I'm not quite sure how that sits, because I also find it a bit unlikely that people knowing minimal alcohol pricing was coming in would wait to buy it afterwards. The only explanation I could think of would be maybe they're going over the border to buy it. I believe this anecdotally, this may have happened.
There's a bit of that happening. There's two sets of figures. The ones you're talking about, which, yeah, they were publicised quite a bit. They're specifically the off-trade figures, the off-licences.
Yeah, which would be the ones that would be hit by minimum pricing.
Exactly, because pubs and clubs aren't affected by it. And the figures I've seen, and they haven't really been properly published online, rather frustratingly, because they're industry figures, but the figures I've seen and were reported correctly is that, yes, indeed, there was a rise in consumption in the first 6 months or so, which public health people then said, oh, well, that's because of the World Cup. And it was a very sunny summer, and we didn't factor in football tournaments being played every 2 years into our model. And obviously,
Scotland did well in the World Cup.
Yeah, Scotland got to the final, didn't they? So that's why it went up. Now the figures I've seen for the full year, it's hard to see whether they went up or down. Actually, they're very close to being either up or down, depending on how you kind of adjust it for population. Mm. Essentially, there's no real difference. So if the sales did fall, which I think they did, it's entirely because of the pub trade, which again is the opposite of what people predicted. I don't know if you remember, but quite a lot of campaigners were saying this is going to be great for pubs because we're going to narrow the gap between the off-trade and the on-trade. Everyone's going to go back into the pubs and start spending there. That was never going to happen, and it hasn't happened. The pub trade has continued to just gradually slide towards the abyss.
Which is a shame, really, because sociable drinking in pubs has great social benefits and indirect health benefits. So probably as many lives have been lost, she said off the top of her head with no evidence. No, it's just, I genuinely think probably more lives are lost when people live more isolated lives. And, you know, there is actually some evidence for that. And getting together sociably and drinking in pubs is a big part of that in British culture.
Yep.
So it's...
So the smoking ban has killed people, essentially,
well,
what you're saying.
Yeah.
Chris, Tamandra, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Do give us a rating, a review, and perhaps even a donation. And if you're anywhere near Edinburgh next month, make sure you get yourself a ticket to Tamandra Harkness's new show, Take a Risk, at the Assembly Roxy. To get tickets and to find out more, just go to takeariskshow.com. That's takeariskshow, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.